Hi, this is Anne Merchant, and welcome to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, the Institute of Medicine, and the National Research Council, collectively known as the National Academies. The world seems to have an insatiable appetite for energy. We consume energy to work, to play, to travel, to live our lives. According to statistics compiled in 2006 by the U.S. Department of Energy, about 85% of the total energy consumed in the United States and about 97% of the energy we use for transportation came from fossil fuels. To get at those fossil fuels, we must dig deep into the earth to mine coal, drill thousands of feet beneath the sea in search of oil, and send geologists to hunt for new sources of natural gas. But as we all know, fossil fuels are non-renewable, which means that once you've used up all the coal, oil, and natural gas, there will be none left. To punctuate that reality, most estimates of domestic oil production indicate that the country has already used more than remains untapped. Today, the United States imports well over 60% of the oil it consumes, a percentage that has been steadily increasing in response to our own dwindling supplies at home. Because it is in our national interest to achieve greater energy independence, biofuels, fuels derived from biological materials or biomass, have become an important source of liquid fuel for the planes, trains, and automobiles that crisscross the country. Will Logan, Senior Program Officer at the Water Science and Technology Board, and the study director who oversaw the National Research Council's colloquium on biofuels, notes the advantages of these new energy sources.
In theory, they're renewable. So if you're based on plants, you can harvest the crop and grow another crop next year. Other sources of energy like oil, gas, coal are non-renewable, which means that once you take them out of the ground and burn them, they're gone. And that kind of brings us to the second advantage, which would be that most biofuels don't contribute as much to global warming as burning oil and gas. And that's because the carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, that you would produce by burning oil or coal, it's been buried underground, isolated from the atmosphere. So it's added newly to the atmosphere. It's new carbon dioxide. Plants that yield biofuels, they take carbon dioxide out of the air while they're growing. So when we burn biofuel, we're just recycling the carbon. Of course, there is some carbon dioxide spent in growing those crops and running the tractors, and that's where a lot of debate comes in. I think a third benefit of biofuels is that for countries that import oil and gas, biofuel production can help them to come closer to self-sufficiency in energy and at the same time creating jobs in rural areas, which often can use them.
The good news is that the potential sources of biomass are plentiful. In 2006, approximately 4.9 billion gallons of ethanol, which is derived mainly from corn kernels, were produced in the United States. But this represents just a fraction of the biofuels portfolio available to us. Other potential sources of materials for use in biofuels include short-rotation woody crops, such as poplar and willow, animal fats, vegetable oils, and recycled greases, perennial grasses, such as switchgrass, agricultural and forestry residues, such as manure and cellulosic waste, aquatic products such as algae and seaweed, and municipal waste such as sewage sludge or solid waste. Biofuels are likely to play a key role in America's energy future. In 2007, President Bush called for U.S. production of ethanol to reach 35 billion gallons per year by 2017, which would displace 15% of the nation's projected annual gasoline use. By 2030, the administration aims to increase that production to 60 billion gallons per year. Recent increases in oil prices, in conjunction with subsidy policies, have led to a dramatic expansion in corn ethanol production and high interest in further expansion over the next decade. Here's Will Logan again.
Several circumstances have favored the development of ethanol as a biofuel over the last 30 years or so. I think following the oil crisis in the mid-1970s, Congress implemented a subsidy which encouraged ethanol fuel additives in gasoline, and that's ranged from 40 to 60 cents per gallon of ethanol produced. Then following Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the price of oil rose over $50 a barrel, and since then it's been well above that price. What that has done is it's caused a gold rush of interest in ethanol production because corn prices were low at the same time that gasoline prices were high.
But along with the many benefits that come from our investment in biofuels come challenges. It's likely that an increased reliance on biofuels will gradually change the nation's agricultural landscape. It's also raising concerns about potential impacts on the nation's water resources. Simply put, growing and processing biofuel crops to meet America's energy needs will alter how the nation's water resources are used. Dr. Logan points to several concerns raised at the colloquium.
Water quality is certainly a major, major issue, and within that, the largest scale issue is what's called the dead zone. The dead zone, it's an area out in the Gulf of Mexico where oxygen levels are so low that almost no marine animals can survive, and it's about the size of New Jersey. Fertilizers coming down the Mississippi are the cause of it. So anything that increases the amount of land in production, such as biofuels, has the potential to make this dead zone even larger. Sedimentation in local streams can also be a big problem for local ecosystems. A lot of the organisms in and around streams need clear, clean water to live in or to lay their eggs in. But the flip side of sedimentation that brings even more concerns is soil erosion. And here's where life gets a bit complicated. If you're using corn as your biomass, it would seem logical to try and find technologies to use the leaves and the stems as well. But as soon as you do that, you run into erosion issues because those stems were on the ground helping to prevent soil loss. So it is an issue that has to be thought through carefully. A final issue would be the water that's used in the biorefineries themselves. It's actually equivalent to a town of maybe 5,000 people, depending on the size of the plant. It may surprise people to know, however, that compared to the water for irrigation, for the irrigating the crop that goes into the biorefineries, this is actually a very small number.
Certainly, the water implications of biofuels production are complex. There are many uncertainties in estimating the overall net impacts of biofuel crops on our water resources. Whether or not biofuel crops will require more or less water will depend on what crop is being substituted and where it's being grown. Another important consideration is how biofuel production might drive the expansion of agriculture into regions that typically are not considered to be agricultural. Depending upon what crops are grown, where the crops are grown, and whether there's an increase in overall agricultural production, significant acceleration of biofuels production could cause much greater water quantity problems than are currently experienced. Increased biofuels production will likely add pressure to the water management challenges the nation already faces as biofuels drive changing agricultural practices, increased corn production, and growth in the number of biorefineries. One of the most potentially significant new biofuels on the horizon is cellulosic ethanol, derived from fibrous materials such as wheat straw, native grasses, and forest trimmings. Although the technology has not yet sufficiently matured to permit anything more than pilot programs and demonstrations, experts predict that full-scale commercial production is expected to begin within the next decade. And as Dr. Logan points out, there are water-related advantages to cellulosic alternatives.
Generally, it is true that cellulosic alternatives have less impact on water quality. The cellulosic crops, such as grasses, for example, typically aren't fertilized, although they could be. And at least as importantly, the soil isn't tilled or disturbed. So even if small amounts of fertilizer were applied, there would be less bare ground to make it easier for erosion and runoff to occur.
As biofuel production expands and technology advances, there is a real opportunity to shape policies to also meet objectives related to water use and quality impacts. To move toward a goal of reducing water impacts of biofuels, a policy bridge will likely be needed to encourage growth of new technologies that develop both traditional and cellulosic crops, requiring less water and fertilizer, and are optimized for fuel production.
The report underlined the complexities of figuring out whether different kinds of biofuels are a quote-unquote good thing or a bad thing. I think as a bottom line, I personally believe that the water quality issues are something to really carefully consider. We certainly don't want to help solve one set of problems just by creating another set.
The National Research Council supports the urgent need for U.S. farm and energy policy that would help shift the biofuel industry toward environmentally friendlier alternatives that use less water and fewer chemical inputs. And while biofuels currently pose only a marginal stress on water supplies regionally, a significant acceleration of biofuel production without proper environmental safeguards could lead to much greater water quantity problems. Given that UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has just named water scarcity as the world's top priority, it seems especially important as we seek to solve one natural resource problem that we shepherd our water resources wisely and responsibly. My name is Anne Merchant, and you've been listening to The Sounds of Science, the podcast brought to you by the National Academies, advisors to the nation on science, engineering, and medicine. Be sure to visit us at our website at nationalacademies.org, where we have more than 3,000 books and publications available full text to read free online.